Fate, the oldest and most respected magazine in its field, presents the most respected paranormal interviewer in broadcasting. Here, in a special collector's series of conversations with well-known scientists and iconoclasts, is your host, Hilly Rose.
Our guest today is a very knowledgeable, a very brilliant, in my opinion, scientist. And I'll tell you all about him in just a moment. His name is Paul LaViolette. And he's got a couple of books that have recently been reissued that caused me to stop and look and wonder. Anytime I begin to wonder, that's a good thing. He's written so many books, so the ones we're going to be talking about today are Decoding the Message of the Pulsars and Earth Under Fire, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But you know that I have had a great interest in the work of SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, and the work they do in the sky. We've had Frank Drake on the program a number of times and a number of other people from SETI. And every time I have Frank Drake on the program, I say, Dr. Drake, the first time I talked to you, you said 10 years, we're going to have this discovery from extraterrestrials. We're going to have the signal. And years go by, and then you say 10 years. And he said yes, and he'd like another 10 years. And so it's really fascinating. Where else could you be working at something so diligently, so scientifically, for well over 30 years and have absolutely nothing to show for it, with the possible exception of the movie that starred Jodie Foster? And that's probably the biggest accomplishment that SETI has. And they continue. They're well-funded. They've got some really, really brilliant people working with them. But my guest today says they're looking in the wrong directions. That really we are getting messages from extraterrestrials. We just are not paying any attention to them. So let me introduce to you now Paul LaViolette. He has written a number of books. He's published many original papers in the areas of physics and astronomy and climatology and systems theory and psychology. He received his B.A. in physics from Johns Hopkins, his M.B.A. from the University of Chicago, and Ph.D. from Portland State University. He's currently president of the Starburst Foundation, which is an interdisciplinary scientific research institute. I could go on and on and on. I mean, this guy's vita is incredible. And he was the first to predict that high-intensity volleys of cosmic ray particles travel directly to our planet from distant sources in our galaxy. And we may be getting warnings from the sky. Now, I hope, Dr. LaViolette, that I have somehow said it all in a way that you agree with. Yes or no?
Yes, pretty good summary.
Okay, I mean it's almost impossible to summarize your career. It's so extensive. But I got to tell you that I went to I Googled you obviously, and it's amazing how the extent of your scientific knowledge and background, and like so many other people, you have been, I don't want to use the word dismissed, but nobody's paid a lot of attention to your theories. But they didn't to Galileo either. In fact, they gave him a lot of trouble. And there are a number of other people through the centuries who have come up with theories that people laughed at, poo-pooed, said nothing, you know, they're not worth looking at, because it jarred what they thought they knew about science. And that goes on today in so many disciplines. So you're not the only one who is sort of being ignored, but I think it's a tragedy. It's a great tragedy. And so I hope in the republication of your two books, which you put out a few years ago, and Bear Publishing? Yeah, Bear and Company has published these, Decoding the Message of the Pulsars and Earth Under Fire. I hope that it will rekindle some interest on the part of science today, and certainly many, many of my listeners. I hope they will take the time to look at your books and the various theories that you have. But can you help us, sir, in trying to understand, and I'm particularly focusing today on this business of the pulsars, the forgetting what you know about the pulsars, what is a pulsar as ordinary science today, the accepted theory of what a pulsar is? I think we have to start there.
Right. So, well, shortly after they were discovered, pulsars are radio sources that pulse at a very regular period, which is unusual for astronomical sources because most of the phenomena we see out there are more or less erratic. They don't repeat with such regularity.
You know, it brings to mind a book, a very well-known book, I believe it was called On the Shore or something like that. It was about a nuclear holocaust that occurred in the world, and there was this repeated beat that they thought there was life remaining. You may remember this book. I think they made a movie out of it as well. And they came to San Francisco and found that it was a lampshade just blowing in the wind. So is it possible that these repeated pulsar, whatever they are, could be something other than extraterrestrial intelligence?
Well, their first reaction was that it was a signal that was of extraterrestrial intelligence origin. And then they came up with a model they thought could explain it, which is this idea of a spinning neutron star. And the trouble is, as they studied the phenomenon over the years, the model they developed to explain this became more and more complex. And even like a model for one pulsar would contradict the model for another pulsar. So there was no way to explain this in a simple way. And that would be the goal if somebody was trying to send signals to us. The goal would be to make them so complex or ordered that we could not mistake to interpret them as natural phenomena. Natural phenomena, you wouldn't expect this kind of ordering.
Okay, so you're saying, I'm confused here. Are you saying that it's clear that this is some kind of intelligence or not?
It is.
It is, okay. According to your book, there were some people, Jocelyn Bell and Anthony Hewish, I think, from Cambridge. And they were the first ones to come up with pulsars, is that correct?
They made the discovery.
They made the discovery. Okay, but what was interesting to me, you point out that when they started discovering these things, they labeled them LGM-1, LGM-2, and LGM standing for little green men.
Right.
So they must have had this feeling that it was some kind of intelligence.
Right, that was their initial conclusion. Because they had determined that this is something that's not local. It's coming from outside the solar system. And they'd never seen anything like this before. And they actually had a closed-door meeting to discuss the whole thing. And eventually they decided not to announce it to the world as this kind of discovery and came up with a model to explain it as a natural type of phenomenon. I guess what steered them away from the extraterrestrial interpretation was that they discovered more than one of these. They ended up discovering four that they had labeled LGM 1 through 4, and they had trouble with the idea that more than one civilization of different parts of the galaxy would be communicating with us at one time. So they were discounting, for example, the idea that there might be a galactic civilization that would be in communication across different parts of the galaxy. And that's what this leads you toward.
Okay, so they stopped labeling these LGMs and somehow began to call it something else.
Pulsars, right.
Okay, pulsars. But science today accepts pulsars, right? I mean, they're there, and they accept that they're sending this repetitive signal of some kind. I mean,
right.
I'm asking, how far does traditional science go in accepting the theory?
Right. They've documented these, published articles about them. So there's no question acknowledging that these exist. That something's totally accepted by the scientific community. And the data is there for anyone who's interested to study it. And what my book does, it shows you that when you do study the data, you see things that can't be explained as being due to chance. That there are patterns indicated, geometrical relations indicated, that are indicative of extraterrestrial communication. And there's actually a message there.
Oh, no. All right, we'll get to that. And that's what's most startling about what's in your book, is that there indeed is a message, and that message is a warning. But let's go just stay with SETI for a moment. You say that SETI fails because they're looking for the wrong thing. And you also indicate that you wish SETI would join you in searching for the correct thing.
Right.
So why do you think SETI fails? What is it that SETI does is wrong in your view?
Well, they were looking for signals sort of like our radio station transmission, sort of like what you're sending out, discrete frequency. So they're assuming that the people out there, the aliens, are going to use the exact same technology that we here are using at this point in time. And that's kind of a narrow assumption. You know, if they do find a civilization that's using that kind of transmission style, they've in effect narrowed the possibilities of what they're going to be detecting to detect a civilization exactly like ours. So I think the problem is they've narrowed down too much what they would accept as extraterrestrial intelligence signal.
Okay, I understand. So you're saying that you'd like them to join you in looking at what's happening with the pulsars. And what is happening? What are the pulsars sending us? It's a beam. Number one, you talked about four pulsars, but there's many, many, many pulsars in the sky.
Yeah, they found something like 1,560 with the last count.
Okay, so, and there's probably many more.
Right.
Okay, 1,560. Well, that's a lot. If somebody's trying to send us a message, they didn't have to go to that extent to have 1,560 beams coming down.
And, right, they're not all, the message is just in a few of these.
Okay. And so let's talk about what you believe these pulsars are. There is some kind of particle beam that comes down and hits the Earth. Is that correct?
More a synchrotron radiation, which would be electromagnetic. It's radio waves. It starts out as the model that I see. You want my model or the conventional model now?
Oh, no, your model, because science has not accepted your theory here. So, I mean, regular science. I'm talking about accepted science.
Yeah, which doesn't mean that it's wrong. It's just that it's sort of like trying to move a mountain when it's one guy or just a group of people pushing. There's a lot of inertia there because the systems. I'm also a systems scientist, and I've studied sociology. Social systems have built-in tendency to reinforce their own processes.
Right.
Well, so they'll keep going in the same direction, even though they see that somebody else might be right. They will discount it because it's more important they continue what they're doing. You know?
Right. I find that in archaeology. I find it in almost every branch of science. So we agree on this. So let's get to what you believe is really going on here.
Right. Well, what I see is that you can imagine a stellar source that's putting out cosmic rays. And the civilization who would be using this has a way of projecting a force field near the surface of the star that's able to decelerate, slow those cosmic rays down, those cosmic rays being charged electrons that are traveling near the speed of light. And when that's done, it would produce a beam of synchrotron radiation, it's called. Now, so far what I've said is pretty much accepted, that the idea that these signals are created by cosmic ray electrons that are being decelerated in a magnetic field and generate radio waves as a result. That's pretty much the model that's accepted. the difference is that I'm saying that the decelerating field is not a natural pole in the star, but something that's placed there and modulated so as to cause the signal to flash on and off.
Okay, let's stop for a second here. You're mentioning stars, and we haven't... You say these things are in the sky, but what is their relation to stars? What are these pulsars? Are they attached to stars?
Well, they would be like a neutron star would serve as the source of the particle, as an example, or you could have a white dwarf that's emitting cosmic rays as another possibility. Sometimes they are in orbit around other stars, or planets might be orbiting them.
So they're not stars themselves, the pulsars?
They would be stars. They were once stars, like a neutron star would have been a star at one time. It would have been surrounded with an atmosphere like our sun, but at a certain point it blew that atmosphere off. Essentially what it is the core of a star. So if you can imagine at the center of the sun, there would be a very dense core. And an older star, the atmosphere gets blown off and you're left with the core, which is very energetic. It would be emitting cosmic ray particles.
Okay, so you're saying that somehow some intelligence is using these dying stars to send us a message. Am I getting that correctly?
Yeah, I wouldn't refer to them as dying, but they're using these stars, these energy sources. Right.
Okay.
Now, the other interpretation is that there is no extraterrestrial civilization system doing this, that this is all due to intelligence of the universe itself. So it's always another interpretation you can put.
Mm-hmm. That's the greater, the bigger picture.
Right. Yeah. So, well, it's up to the reader which way they want to interpret it.
I understand. Okay, you say that these beams are coming down and that they have a... well, you feel it, and I'm reading directly from your book, Decoding the Pulsars. If pulsars are ETI beacons that have been fabricated by technically advanced galactic civilizations, their existence would have some very profound implications. What are those implications?
Well, first of all, that 'cause there's so many of them, the different parts of the galaxy would imply that there is a galactic-level civilization, that we're not dealing with just one star that's sending us a message, that there's actually kind of a galactic club that also they have the ability to travel at faster than the speed of light or communicate at faster than the speed of light between these various parts of the galaxy, because otherwise how would they orchestrate a message for a system like this that would give us any kind of reasonable message at this point in time at this place where we are. Because some of the, like, for example, one of these pulsars that I talk about, or two of these pulsars, they're separated in space by 7,000 light years, and yet they're creating a geometrical relationship that we see at this time from our particular perspective. And that would only be possible if somehow they were able to orchestrate this.
Well, definitely 7,000, but you also indicate that the distribution of these pulsars stretches out over a distance of more than 100,000 light years.
Right, 200,000.
Oh, that's incredible. I mean, it's almost beyond imagining.
Right. It raises a lot of... It stretches the imagination to put your mind around the whole thing. And yet, if you are left with the idea of natural interpretation, the question is the chance of these particular relationships occurring. And I come up with one figure, 10 to the 28th, 1 over 10 to the 28th, as the likelihood that this is due to natural chance.
Okay, well... I've heard about force field beams. Don't we use this? Doesn't the military, at least they're experimenting with force field beams, And
right.
I mean, so there's nothing really new about this. It's just that we're discovering that it occurs naturally or with some other intelligence in space. I mean, is it the same thing, these force field beams that we humans are trying to deal with? Is it the same kind of technology?
Technology that we have developed. So you, based on the technologies we've developed, you can come up with a theory of how these signals could be produced. We have a technology where you could send a microwave beam great distance, like, in our case, we do it just on Earth, like over hundreds of miles or so, and it's able to create forces at that distant location. If you scale that up, you could imagine a civilization using that over, maybe a hundredth of a light year or so to create a force field on a star and affect the star somehow.
Yeah, well, is this the same kind of thing? I mean, most of my audience knows what HARP is. Is this the same kind of thing that HARP uses?
That kind of technology, right. A little different from HARP, but that idea of using microwave beams, probably in popular culture, the closest idea would be in Star Trek, where they have phaser beams and energy shields. These things are possible with the kind of technology they're working on in defense. It's all classified, but you can kind of figure what's going on as you have an understanding of the technology.
Okay, so you say that these beams that are coming down from these pulsars with a specific fluctuation, if that's the word for it, are trying to send us a message of some kind.
It's more what I've seen is in the locations of the pulsars. There's certain pulsars that have very unique characteristics that have been placed at certain geometrically significant locations in the galaxy, and it's in that sense that they are conveying the message. Also, for example, they show the pi ratio, which is something you wouldn't expect in nature. Like in one case, they're marking the point that's 1 radian from the center of the galaxy. So if you were to imagine we're in a spiral galaxy and look towards the center of the galaxy, which would be in the Scorpius-Sagittarius region, and imagine that... Let's draw a circle. Say we're at the center, and at the edge of the circle, that's where the center of the galaxy is. So now you would mark off a distance of 1 radian, which is if you took the radius of the circle and marked it on its circumference, you would be marking an angle of about 57 degrees. And so that's a key geometrical concept. And right there is where you find the second fastest pulsing pulsar in the sky. And chances of this, of finding such a unique pulsar at that point, is incredibly small, especially considering all the other unusual characteristics of this particular pulsar, like giant pulses. It will, every so often, it will flare up to produce very intense radio emission, which is very rare among pulsars. Also, it's one of 5 pulsars that produce optical pulses.
Popsicle?
Optical. So most pulsars are just emitting radio pulses, but there's 5 pulsars that are emitting optical flashes.
And what does that mean?
They flash visibly. You actually see it as a flash of light. And 3 of those pulsars are part of this message that I'm talking about, 3 of the ones that are optical flashers.
Now, I'm just trying to follow you here. So out of these 1,560 pulsars that have been discovered, you say there are 3 specifically that are sending us a message. Is that correct?
There's more than 3, but 3 of the ones that produce optical flashes, 3 of the 5, are involved in this message. So the one is the what I call a millisecond pulsar. It's close to this 1 radian point in the galaxy, on the galactic very close to the galactic equator. It comes within 0.4 of a degree of the one radian point. And the other two are the ones that mark the Crab and Vela supernova remnants, which are the two closest young supernova remnants to the solar system, which is very interesting that they would be marking these particular remnants.
Well, if forgive me again, I'm not a physicist, and I'm trying to clearly understand what you're saying. But if you've got a beam that is sending a repetitive signal, doesn't change, and you've also got some flashing light, how can you interpret that to have a message in it? Wouldn't, I mean, we all know what the Morse code is, for example, and the dot system, and that makes sense because it changes. But if it's the same thing repetitively, and it's been going on probably for centuries, what makes
you... haven't analyzed the signals like you're suggesting to look for a message in the signal.
Right.
All I'm saying is that their locations are they're marking certain locations in the sky which have a geometrical significance to us.
Okay, I'm understanding that. But you're also saying they're sending us a message, and that message is a warning. And you're basing that on these signals? Or
right. Just not on the signals themselves. There's nothing in the signals that I have studied yet. In other words, the project hasn't gone to that point. That would be the next step, would be to look at, to analyze the signals themselves. And that's an immense project. It requires a lot of money and time, many scientists to do.
Well, then how do you know that there's a message in here and that that message is a warning?
Like I say, the geometrical relationships, which I can't communicate over the radio. I would need a television screen to show this.
All right, well, then let's go back.
Or to read my book would be the best.
Right, but let's go back to your other book, Earth Under Fire, which seems to me is correlative. You talk about something.
Could I give out the website for ordering book?
Sure. If you, for people who want to get this book, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because the main goal here is to for people to get at the information. It's www.etheric.com.
Etheric, spell that for me.
Etheric.com.
So if people want to see what we're talking about here, then that's a way to go to get the book.
And also the 800 number. It's 1-800-715-9993.
Okay, we'll give that again at the end of the show, so people don't start sitting there with a pencil.
Let me give you an example of like this pi ratio idea. Like the second and third fastest pulsars, turns out they're in the same part of the sky, which is very unusual to find two pulsars. The two of the three fastest pulsars in the sky to be so close together. And if you look at the ratio you take of the one pulsar that's the closest to the one radian point that we were talking about, and look at that angle deviation from that unique point, and then you look at the angle deviation between that pulsar and its partner pulsar, this other one we're talking about, it comes out very close to the 2 pi ratio, which is not something you would expect due to chance. And when you look at that in relation to other sightings, there's alignments where they see alignments with certain stars where the pulsars are sort of indicating they're marking certain stars. For example, there's the Sagitta constellation, which is an arrow, which is in that part of the sky. It's the Sagitta means arrow in Latin. And it's part of our star lore. And it's interesting that the tip of the arrow in our own star lore is also the closest star to this one radian point. So it's for example, and they are marking the location of this, too.
All right, well, I was trying to make this understandable to those of us who aren't scientists.
I can understand how it In a short time, it's difficult.
All right, but that's why I wanted to get to the other book, Earth Under Fire, because, you know, we've talked to people like Dr. Schock out of Boston, and the work he's done with the Sphinx. And we've talked to many other people about the Great Pyramids and how they are all placed in conjunction with the sky. And that's correlative to what you're talking about. So maybe we just should spend a few moments with some of the information that's in this book on Earth Under Fire. Why, in your view, is the Sphinx important to astrology? And how does that relate to these pulsars?
Okay. When I was at Portland State doing my doctoral degree, that's when I made the discovery that the zodiac has a message in it also. And you find there's two pointer indicators in the zodiac, one being the arrow of Sagittarius. There's two arrows in the sky. One is the one that's in the bow of Sagittarius, and that's aimed at the heart of the scorpion, according to myth. And the other is Sagitta, which is the one we were talking about. And what I found was that this arrow was very closely indicating the point of the center of the galaxy, the location of the center of the galaxy. And that's something that we've only discovered recently with radio telescopes, because you don't see the center. It's obscured by dust. When I saw this, and I saw that the zodiac was using through its symbology, which I discussed the symbology a bit in Earth Under Fire, was conveying the idea that there had been an explosion of the core on a particular date.
Core of the galaxy.
The core of our galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, galactic core explosions are something that are known to astronomers. It's something we see going on in other spiral galaxies. And it appears that about 15 to 20% chance of seeing a spiral galaxy in an explosive state where its core is actually active. Past view of astronomers has been that these occur very rarely, like every 100 million years or so. And when they do occur, they last millions of years. And what I realized, which is that I realized that this is incorrect. What actually happens is that galaxies go through their explosive cycle much more quickly, that we have a period of something like 13,000, 26,000 years between outbursts in our own galaxy, and that they last anywhere from 100 years or so to a few thousand years. This became the topic of my dissertation, and actually my discovery of this pulsar message that we were discussing earlier played a role. Without that, it was both that and my delving into zodiac lore that allowed me to form the idea. And all the results of that investigation have turned out correct. There were something like 14 previously published predictions that I made that have been since verified. So when you get that kind of track record, you figure you are on the right path.
So you feel all of this says that there's something important in astrology, which pretty much science says is a pseudoscience. They just sort of brush it off as not being important.
Well, usually scientists are referring to its use in horoscope astrology, and there's a lot of discussions on that. And I don't want to get into that area. I'm simply interpreting it, its lore, saying that there's an advanced science encoded in it. How, which civilization came about this, I can't say. You know, where did they get the level of advancement to know these concepts? Because, for example, some of these ideas we just discovered ourselves in the last 50 years.
We talk a lot on this program about other civilizations, like the Hopi Indians, for example, talking about we're being in the fourth world. There were three worlds before ours.
Right.
And so I think my audience understands what you're saying here, some of these messages are encoded, and some of the civilizations just carry that message forward without understanding it.
Exactly. and eventually civilization like our own gets to the level where we have the ability to then understand the message. And this is really the riddle of the Sphinx. That's what the whole idea of the riddle of the Sphinx was. The Sphinx, the astrological Sphinx is formed from the four fixed signs of the zodiac. And you find when you've understood that the zodiac is designed like a cryptogram. And by the way, I have on my website a game where people can attempt to decipher the cryptogram. You realize that the Sphinx is one of the keys to, because there's a certain sequence that you have to put the signs in. And the Tarot is another key, Tarot being the major, first 11 major arcana. And if you get into esoteric tradition, they teach that there's a relationship between the Tarot and astrology, between the signs and the arcana.
So in other words, all of these things that a lot of people play games with and, you know, sort of misinterpret because they don't know what they're talking about, they all have some scientific basis, is what you're saying.
Right. Well, actually, there's like been several hundred variations of the original Tarot. Like, for example, the Marseille deck was one of the first. But people come up with their own Tarot decks, and you can use any, really, you can use any Tarot deck you want. If you're doing, for example, a prediction of the future, reading people's cards. It's another thing to say that there's a science encoded in there, and that this is something that's taught by esoteric teachers, that the Tarot traditionally had a science that was encoded in it, but the meaning of the science was lost. What I was taught in one class I took was that the first 11 cards were indicating the creation of the universe, how that took place. Well, it turns out with our current knowledge, things we've learned in the last 50 years, of how wave patterns emerge in chemical reaction systems, you can apply that to cosmology. You find that this is describing a process of how matter is created. Matter being like a particle, subatomic particle. Think of a particle as a wave. How does the wave emerge in space? And you can compare that to how a chemical reaction wave emerges in a chemical reaction medium. Apparently, they're using the science that they use. It's an alchemic science. It's encoded in the zodiac and in the tarot. And this was their physics that they... way they understood matter being created.
Okay, well, if I can then go back to your book, Decoding the Pulsars, you seem to feel that these particle beams have something to do with crop circles. And, of course, crop circles are, you know, very big in our discussions over the years, trying to decipher what that's all about. And I think the audience you're talking to doesn't need to be told that they're not all man-made, as some people would have you say, that there are a number. I mean, Colin Andrews, for example, has been on the program many times and talks about the 20% that we don't understand at all. We're not talking about the Mandelbrot, which is probably something that somebody designed that was not out of space. But how does all that relate then? What do these pulsars have to do with crop circles?
Well, I was... giving that as an example of how a microwave beam could be made to exert force at a distance, because that's the technology that I'm proposing is being used in the case of the pulsars, where I was saying they project microwave beams to the surface of a neutron star to be able to modulate the cosmic rays and create these flashes of radio signals that the cosmic rays would produce. So to show that... something like this is going on in front of our very eyes. I give as an example the crop circle, because here it requires some sort of force to flatten out the crops. And all the various studies that have been performed point towards the idea that these are produced by microwaves. They look at the effects on the crops, and they are effects that would be the kind you would get if there was they were exposed to microwave radiation.
Like the work of Professor Levengood, yeah. in seeing that the heat in the kernels, is that what you're talking about?
Yes, and then you have some sightings where people have seen UFOs with beams coming down. In other cases, now there's also has been suggested that these are produced by satellites that we might have. As to whether they're part of some classified program or extraterrestrial is a question, but it seems there's a lot of evidence that it's part of the effort of extraterrestrial communication, part another way that they're sending signals to us.
Okay, well, you also seem to relate all this to the possibility of the tsunami of 2004, that it has some kind of relationship to these ray bursts.
I was the first to suggest that cosmic rays could come at the speed of light through the galaxy to us without being diffused, because the previous views was that if you had an explosion at a distant star, those rays probably wouldn't reach you because they'd be trapped by magnetic fields. Well, here's an example. It was a star that was close to the center of the galaxy. It wasn't the galactic center, but it was a star close to that that exploded and produced the most powerful gamma ray burst in the history of observation. So in the last 30 years or so that we've been observing these, this really topped all the rest. And it's really interesting that it occurred just 2 days after the tsunami, which was the biggest earthquake that we'd had in 30 years or so.
And you feel there's a relationship?
Right. I was suggesting that if you did have an explosion from a distant star, that it would very likely produce a gravity wave, and that the gravity wave would arrive slightly before the cosmic ray, the gamma ray burst, and because gamma rays can be scattered. And so they don't take exactly direct course, where the gravity waves go straight. And to find that something that's 23,000 light years away would have, it's very possible that you would get that much delay between the gravity wave and the gamma ray burst. So it's really the gravity wave that would be what had triggered the earthquake. It didn't really produce it, but it could have triggered the tensions that the Earth already had enough to release that suddenly and create that tsunami.
Okay, well, we started out saying that these beacons from the sky, at least some of them, are trying to give us a warning. But we haven't touched what that warning is. And I'm wondering, you know, what can we learn and what can we do about it, even if we do understand the warning?
Well, they were pointing out the last superwave that passed us, which would have been between about 15,000 and 11,000 years ago.
Is after the Ice Age or not?
Right at the end of the Ice Age.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that this is what ended the Ice Age, because it affected the sun. It caused the sun to heat up, became more active. There's evidence from the moon and the Earth that at that period the sun was very active, flaring maybe 100 or 1,000 times more solar flare activity than we see today, even at the peak. And so that would have warmed things up enough to melt the ice sheet. The pulsars, some of these very unique pulsars, the Crab and Vela pulsar, one is the brightest pulsar in the sky, and the other is the most luminous in terms of amount of energy it's putting out. These pulse not only at radio frequencies, but at optical and X-ray and gamma ray. So they're very broad range. By the way, when I say radio, all the pulsars, they're emitting at over a very broad frequency range, covering the whole radio spectrum. But in this case, these are so unique, the crab envelope pulsars are so unique, besides the fact that they mark these supernova remnants that kind of attract your attention there. And you realize when you study those two remnants that their dates, the dates that they exploded, would have been coinciding with a gravity wave moving away from the galactic center at the speed of light, dating from the time of this event, that this event would have passed the Earth. The Vela is the closest supernova remnant, so you see that would have been detonated first about 13,000 years ago. And then as this super wave, I call these galactic super waves, moved out from the center of the galaxy, it then would have detonated the Crab supernova remnant.
Okay, but if there's a message in here, I want to relate this to global warming, which everybody understands. There's no doubt there's global warming. The question is to what degree are we facilitating it? But there has been global warming many times over the history of the Earth. And so even if there was a warning that said, hey, you're going to have global warming and it's going to destroy you, what am I supposed to do with that information? I mean, because obviously it did destroy whatever civilizations occurred many times over. It destroyed the animals and destroyed the vegetation and everything else. Maybe not the cockroaches, but that's about it. So I'm trying.
The last time this happened, civilization was reduced to living in caves, basically. If we had a science before, which seems likely, it went to zero at one point, practically. We had to start over. We were at a survival level. And if we could know that about the phenomenon and take precautions to somehow survive the phenomenon, then civilization wouldn't go through that dark age period. Now, I think that's the goal, is for a civilization to make it through these events.
Well, wait a minute. Are you saying that if we knew that was going to happen, we should somehow encapsulate this information, as you suggest, that that astrology and the position of these pulsars and that all of these things, is this encapsulated information that we just don't understand? Is that what you're saying? I don't mean to simplify it here. I'm just trying to understand it.
Okay. Well, as far as surviving the event, there are some things that could be done if technology was directed in that direction, which would be, for example, setting up a shield. I think that's beyond capability of our civilization in terms of the monetary expense to do that. This would be a shield that could deflect cosmic rays. That would require us to get help from others, so to speak. The gravity wave part, I don't think we could stop that. I don't think there's any way to stop a gravity wave. So that would obviously cause destruction. But there's, when you know what has happened in your past, you can approach the future more positively and not later say, well, God did that to us because we were bad. And that's what happened with the last one. Put in a religious context that humanity was bad and we got punished. You know, I don't think that helps to ensure survival in the future. I think the more one understands about natural phenomena that can cause cataclysms on the Earth, the better it is, less fear there is as a result, because people understand what's happening. And there are certain things you could do. For example, not all of these are going to be as intense as the one that happened at the end of the last ice age. There's a lot of smaller ones, but if they were happening, all you'd have to do is stay indoors, for example, to keep out of the electron shower, which wouldn't be that bad. And so there's simple precautions like that that even, you know, like even if one was to happen in the next few hundred years, it would be very useful to us.
Well, I know they're predicting a huge sunstorm, 2012 roughly? that's going to disrupt all the satellites and our communication. So is that part and parcel of this?
Yeah, now these are theories that people have, and it's very difficult to say when is the next superwave going to arrive. People always ask me that. I say, I don't know. I mean, you look at the galactic center now, and things look calm, except for periodic small eruptions, very small. But things could change very quickly. It's, you know, we don't have a historical record of observing the galactic center over a very long time. You know, for all we know, in a matter of days, it could become extremely active. There are some science fiction stories that have been written along these lines, like Fred Hoyle's book, Inferno. The thing is to be prepared, not to handle it the way we handled the gamma ray burst that happened after the tsunami, where they kept it secret from the public for a month and a half. It occurred in December, and they didn't announce it till middle of February. Now, you know, if something like that happens where the public should know about it, that the information should get out quickly.
All right, so if I can summarize, and I'm sorry to keep doing this, but I know that there are people scratching their heads and saying, because they haven't read your book, what in the world are they talking about here? You're suggesting that there are these particle beams that are coming down with this repetitive signal, and somehow...
Radio beams,
right. And it is somehow warning us about another catastrophe. Am I correct in this?
Right, that there are certain of these pulsars due to their position that through their locations, you can it brings your attention to this superwave event horizon and the concept of a superwave traveling at the speed of light out from the galactic center, reaching Earth and going beyond, and actually showing you where is the current event horizon of that superwave. Out of the 1,560 pulsars, there might be half a dozen that are involved just in this particular message. The question is, what is the purpose of all the others? And in the book, I suggest that they're due to that they are being used for navigation. They would make ideal beacons, sort of like a galactic GPS system, which would be used for navigation.
Well, the theories are fascinating, and of course, with all of your background, there's so much science involved in all of this. But I have to ask the question, are you alone in this, or are other people willing to accept it and say, yes, it's possible that this could have, I mean, anybody can say it's possible, but is there anybody willing to go along with you on it? Like, for example, SETI has this whole organization and a number of scientists, and they're all working in what you claim is the wrong direction. And I'm saying, is there anybody else going along with you on this, or are you all alone?
Yes. Let's say that I get letters all the time from people who have read my books that thank me for writing them, that it's opened their eyes on these things. I haven't gotten any critical letters at all.
Because it's hard to dispute you.
Well, you know, I'm doing is presenting evidence, and when you see all, I guess I'm good at bringing things together. I'm not making this up. I reference everything, and I show here is what we find from the various data, geological, astronomical, from mythology. And when you see it all, you see that the pattern emerges. It's sort of like it's like going to the scene of a crime in the case of the superwave event and looking at the evidence and trying to piece together what happened.
It's sort of like the most popular TV show these days is CSI.
Right, exactly. That's what you're doing.
Wow. All right, Paul, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your taking this time to help us to understand all the things you're saying, and I do commend your books to people. And if they do want to get them, why don't you give us the website and the telephone number again?
www.etheric.com, E-T-H-E-R-I-C, and telephone 800-1-800-715. 9993.
All right, that's Dr. Paul LaViolette. And, wow. You know, it's a great big world out there. Read his books. You'll be interested.
Bait, the oldest and most respected magazine in its field, has brought you another in this series of Collector's Conversations with your host, Hilly Rose.